This is an ABC podcast.
Hi, I'm Amanda Vanstone. You're on Radio National Counterpoint. Thanks for joining us. Civilization isn't about architecture and the arts. They're the consequences of it. We, you and I, are it, the values we share and adopt, and we have a responsibility to pass that on. The classics in literature pass on so much about humanity, but are they being discarded in favour of identity politics? And are you vulnerable to being hacked? Well, we all are. But first to Viktor Orban, an unlikely hero. But Hungary may be demonstrating to the world how to manage some of our current difficulties.
Immigration's a big topic in Australia, rightly so, we're one of the three big immigration countries. But it's now a topic all around the world. And the question being asked by our guest is, does Hungary show the path to the West for survival? And in that, what he's actually talking about is Hungary maintaining its identity. Now, that's often seen as being something that's particularly right-wing or ethnic conservatism. But there's a point here as to whether the European Union is actually using migration to make everyone feel as if they're part of just one thing, that is the Union. Joining me now is the founding editor of the American Conservative, Scott McConnell. Scott McConnell, welcome to Counterpoint.
Thank you for having me, Amanda.
Now, Viktor Orban, he doesn't sort of rate as the great Democrat of the century, does he?
Well, he's not as bad as he's sometimes portrayed. But yes, he's accused of transgressing European values in Hungary a great deal, which seems to me a little bit of a nonsense. And there's no question that he's made it harder for the opposition press and things like that. But Hungary is basically a functioning democracy.
They have pretty fair elections, don't they?
Yes, they do. And Orban has won them pretty decisively, at least the recent ones, yeah.
So what puts him at odds with the EU?
Well, it really began in 2015 when Angela Merkel basically said to all the refugees in Syria and essentially all those beyond Syria in both Asia and Africa to come on in and Europe will welcome you. And she was in a position to speak for Europe because everybody, you know, heard her just started marching to Europe. And Hungary was the first country, I think, and I think some of the Eastern European countries too, which were acting as like transit points for these hundreds and hundreds of thousands of young men, you know, migrants. I don't think that they were all refugees by any stretch of the imagination, who were, you know, en route to Germany, Austria, Sweden, or wherever. They had taken over the train station in Budapest. And Orban set out the army to build fences around, so Hungary couldn't be used as a transit point. Merkel then began to sort of say that, well, you know, Germany can't take all these refugees, and she began to, like, you know, say all the other countries should have to take their share, even though she was the one who summoned this mass migration. And so Hungary and also the Czech Republic and also Poland just said, you know, no, we take a few immigrants, we want limited immigration, but we don't want a mass immigration. And we don't want to be told by Angela Merkel that we're going to have a mass immigration because, for whatever reasons, Germany feels, you know, I mean, I think historic guilt plays a big part of it, just feels it doesn't have a right to exist as a nation state. And since then, Orban has not backed down. He has sort of made controlling immigration a major part of what he's about in international forums and everything like that. He's made a lot of speeches about it. And it's kind of remarkable because Hungary is, you know, it's a small country. It's not particularly powerful. It is somewhat dependent on revenue sharing and subsidies from the richer countries in Western Europe. So he's taking a bit of a risk, but it's popular in Hungary. I mean, Hungary looks at what's happened with multiculturalism in the West, and, you know, they just don't see it as being very successful. And so Orbán said, thank you very much, but we want to remain Hungarian.
I get that. Now, the former president of the Czech Republic, Klaus, has a view about Western elites supporting mass immigration.
Yeah, well, he does. He sees it in part as kind of a power grab by the European Union to sort of use immigration to break down national resistance to an increased centralization of power in Brussels. And it's an argument where he talks about everything except nation states is kind of downgraded by the EU, you know, so there's regional this, and migration and all that. And whereas the resistance to mass immigration increasingly comes from people who do it in the name of nationalism and the nation state. So I don't think that's the only, you know, reason. I mean, I think there is a common European feeling among the conservative anti-immigration parties, and they don't want to go back to, you know, the Europe of 1914 or something like that at all. But it turns to break down that the easiest thing to say is, we want to protect our national identity. That seems to resonate most with European voters.
Mm. And it's the Europeans in the East, apparently, that most remember progressive visions not working in the past and now firmly hold on to that memory, in contrast to what Western European intellectuals might think.
Yeah. The East-West distinction, I think, is very important and is interesting. I mean, because one of the arguments which Western European elites use to justify mass immigration is a feeling of historical guilt. It can be, you know, for obvious reasons, as in Germany, but it's also because of colonialism, or they can say, well, we were colonists, so we're just getting what we did in return. You know, so any negative impact of mass migration is sort of pulled back to, like, we deserve this. If it's suffering, and sometimes they admit that it's causing their countries to suffer, they say, well, we deserve it. And that feeling of guilt, it's a deep one, and it's pervasive in the West. But it doesn't really exist in Eastern Europe, because Eastern Europe, I mean, their recent historical memory is of being victimized by the Soviet Union and by communism. And their national resistance, which, you know, I think was a great reason that the West won the Cold War, the core ideas which enabled Eastern Europe to resist communism were national ideas. And then they don't feel guilty about it. And they don't feel guilty about saying, well, you know, Hungary, not the greatest country in the world, not the most powerful country in the world, but we like it kind of as it is, and we want to, you know, grow it ourselves. And we don't need a million migrants from
somewhere else,
in Africa to do it for us.
Yeah. I'm talking with Scott McConnell, the founding editor of the American Conservative, about whether Hungary, or Eastern Europe perhaps, shows the West a path to survival. Scott, you told the story about your first encounter with Eastern Europeans not having much truck with Western intellectuals, how bracing that experience was. Can you share that story?
Sure. I was in graduate school in 1976, you get a sense of how old I am, and it was a sort of a small lecture course taught by a professor who was very well-liked. I didn't name him in the piece, but it's Mark Kesselman, and he was a Marxist, and he was, you know, not a hardline Stalinist or anything like that, and he was, you know, kind of fair-minded and very nice, well-liked guy. The course was like the state and capitalist society, and we read a lot of Marxist texts, and it's hard to remember that era. But socialism and Marxism were pretty popular in the West in 1976. I mean, there was the beginning to be, because of Cambodia and the boat people in Vietnam and Solzhenitsyn, a turn against it, but this was just before that. And so it was fairly commonplace for, like, you know, people who read books to think that, you know, some form of socialism, not necessarily the Soviet kind or the Chinese kind, but is inevitable and desirable. And Kesselman, you know, he was a good scholar and he knew his stuff, and there were a lot of fancy theoretical Marxist texts there. But there was these two poles in the class. One was a woman about say 30, and one was a young guy about 24, and they just, in a way that intellectuals didn't do in New York in 1976, they just thought communism and Marxism in all forms was just tragically misguided, and they were vocal about it, and it was refreshing, and it kind of brought a lot of people who may have sort of thought that but hadn't quite heard it vocalized. It emboldened them and encouraged them.
Vocalized from people who'd had the experience. I mean, the woman of the two you're talking about
had been in jail in Poland,
Now, you talk about the Eastern Europeans having blessed immunity to the guilt and self-hatred permeating much of the West. Have you given some thought to where that guilt and self-hatred comes from? What is it about Western Europeans that make them feel that way?
Well, it's complicated. I mean, I know there's...
Life is, you know.
Yeah, it is complicated. I mean, part of it is it's just like a trope used by the left, which is a radical criticism, to point to the flaws or, in some case, the crimes of the West and make those identical to the West as all. Like, you know, colonialism. I'm not going to defend French colonialism. I actually wrote a dissertation about it, but it certainly had some good aspects, but I don't think the fact that French and British had colonial empires makes their societies bad in some way. I mean, these were the most creative societies in terms of producing wealth, of science, and most importantly, of democracy. I mean, these are things which came from the West, and the West should be proud of them. The West should not hate itself. And certainly these issues exist in Australia. And, you know, it's the case in the United States, too. Should the United States be defined by slavery or the fact that, you know, settlers came and essentially pushed out all the native Indian tribes? I don't think so. I don't think that should be part of what we consider the West. To a degree which other societies don't feel, like, there's a gnawing feeling in much of the West that we don't deserve to survive as cultures and people. And so, you know, multiculturalism is part of that. This sentiment existed before mass immigration was an issue. I mean, it used to be transformed into various kinds of, you know, Marxist ideology and look for the appropriate kind of communist model. If it's, you know, Russia, if it's not Russia, it's China, or it's Vietnam, or it's Cuba, or, you know, anything that is radically opposed. And now there's a little bit of that. I mean, there's an alliance in France, particularly what's called Islamo-Gauchism, a sort of alliance in spirit between groups which don't have much in common with each other, which is like the radical left and radical Islam. I mean, don't have much in common with each other in terms of even explicitly what they claim to admire. But, yeah, there is guilt. I mean, China, I don't think, feels very guilty about anything. Certainly Chinese individuals do and are capable of feeling guilt and shame. But as a society, the idea that China is bad because of the past, it just isn't a part of political discourse.
Well, Scott McConnell, founding editor of the American Conservative, you've opened my eyes. Up until now, I would have never said we should look to Viktor Orban to learn some lessons, and now I think I will. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much, Amanda.
Hungary today is a long way from ancient Greece and Rome. But civilization is not about buildings, it's about shared values. You might have read about the impending downfall of Western civilization, and if you haven't, you've certainly read plenty critical of Western civilization. Plenty. You have to ask yourself why. It's done a pretty good job, actually. And the critical people, to the best of my knowledge, don't have a better plan. So I'm a bit over it, actually, all the criticism of Western civilization. So it was a delight to see that Wolfgang Kasper, who's the Emeritus Professor of Economics at the University of New South Wales, the Australian Defence Force Academy, has done a piece for the Centre for Independent Studies entitled, Does Western Civilization Have a Future? It's a very good question, and Wolfgang Kasper joins me now. Wolfgang Kasper, welcome to Counterpoint.
It's a pleasure.
Well, you know, I think Western civilization has done a pretty good job, actually.
Oh, I agree. Not only in the traditional Western countries, which have reached an unimaginable level of living standard and freedom from violence, but also in those third world countries that have absorbed a lot from the rule system that makes Western civilization.
People are wealthier, they're healthier, they're living longer.
Yes.
Hopefully they're happier. I'm not sure about that. But
as a matter of fact, Amanda, wealthier people tend to be more content with their lives. It is a plain lie to say that wealth makes you unhappy.
I wouldn't mind Wolfgang putting that to the test, but in any event, we'll see how we go. What would you say are the special characteristics of Western civilization? It's not just English-speaking people. So what would you say to just say we've been joined at our coffee table by a 15-year-old and he says to you, well, Professor Casper, what are the essential characteristics of the Western civilization? What would you say to him?
Well, first of all, what really makes civilization are rules, invisible things like customs and beliefs and laws and how they are enforced. And that, of course, then results in visible things, in hardware like architecture, implements that we use, etc. That is civilization in any case. Now, Western civilization, which arose in Europe about 1,000 years ago or so, had its sources in competition between different countries, different rulers. And they, by that competition, were forced to grant freedoms and more leeway to individual initiative. In other words, the key characteristic of Western civilization is more freedom for the individual. We have gradually developed a community of free individuals who are self-responsible and ruled by democratic government. That is absolutely new in the history of mankind, because in other areas, there was a ruler by the grace of God or whatever military power who then just ruled subjects.
Well, that's right. I was interested to hear you say that civilization is about sort of shared rules. And I know in the piece that you've written, you talk about the importance of shared values that really form the civilization, which is largely agreed amongst whatever community we're talking about, over which is laid the external aspects of civilization, that is the rules, the laws that we pass. And what that highlights is that we, the people, are the civilization, how we behave, the values we adopt and pass on to future generations. And it's got very little to do with, you know, Greek and Roman temples that are often highlighted in TV programs as being, you know, civilization. Well, they're the remnants thereof. But I think, anyway, that we understand we are it and we have the obligation to pass this on. The laws of the land are just the outer shell. It won't work if we don't all agree. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely. What is typical in the history of these civilizations all around the world that have risen and fallen is that some shared beliefs and values and rules were cultivated, were embraced by people, civilizations ruled and created all these temples and all these magnificent things. But then dissension, especially amongst the elites, set in. People felt betrayed and became very vulnerable. And in these situations, typically, you had either a climate change, you had an external aggression, an invasion, and then civilizations fell. We in the West have so far avoided this, but we had repeated crises where it looked as if we were going down the chute as well.
Mm. Now, let's jump forward to the present and the sort of risk factors that are out there that those who want to protect Western civilization need to take into account. Now, one of them you mention is mass migration from failed states. That's pretty obvious, isn't it? But the solution to it isn't, is it? That's the hard part at the moment.
That is a new and major challenge which is exercising my mind a lot. We know, if we go back in history, how the invasion of those Teutonic tribes, the Goths and the Vandals, etc., brought Roman civilization to its knees. Now we are faced with mass immigration of people of very limited means and no skills to handle modern technology, coming in caravans and wanting to come in. And the danger is that if our society, our rules and values get diluted by these people who can't integrate easily, then we are in serious troubles. We don't want to repeat the experience of the end of Roman civilization.
No. Now, what about the democratic socialists who you describe as trying to win popular votes by promising tax-funded welfare? But you draw a distinction between the Hawke Keating era and the current era. Can you fill out that distinction?
When I came as a short-term visitor to Australia, I despaired a little how this resource-rich country, young country, was really held back by protectionism, by regulations in the credit markets that were crazy. And then lo and behold, Hawke and Keating, with the support of then opposition, led to reforms which I had not expected. And we know that we owe a lot of the recent 20, 25 years of prosperity to this reform movement being kicked off. And the Howard Costello era, of course, continued that. Quite in contrast to this, the Labour Party now is talking about re-regulation. They want to overturn labour market reforms that Keating pushed through, not knowing or not wanting to know how harmful that would be to Australia's prosperity in the world. We have to do everything to make this well-placed country internationally competitive and keep it that way. And it's not only digging resources out of the ground. A lot has to do with having good rules, with self-responsible people doing good work in the service sector and educating people from all around the world in understanding our rules and maybe imitating them later in their own countries.
Mm. And what about the question of bureaucracies? With government getting bigger and bigger, not necessarily because it wants to, but because new fields open up that perhaps need regulation, like space, for example, or telecommunications. And now we find that, not to put too fine a point on it, parliaments are elected and they're meant to work in partnership, if you like, with the public service. I mean, when I was a minister, I saw myself in partnership with the secretary of the department. Just an unfortunate partnership that I'd have to wear the odium if things went wrong. But in any event, you have to work together because that department has an enormous amount of information. But I always had in the back of my mind this creeping feeling that really, they've got so much information there that the bureaucrats could be said to try and run the show if you don't have a strong minister that insists on, you know, more varied advice than you're currently getting. What do you see about the risk of non-elected bureaucrats actually running the show and therefore making the democratic system seem a bit hollow?
Our democratic system has become hollow and vulnerable. I'm not quite convinced that it is unavoidable that the bureaucracy gets bigger and bigger. We can hand a lot of the decision-making that is made in our society back to individuals who compete in markets and correct each other. But we have more and more centralization, and we do have a bureaucracy which is really in control of all the information. And I feel sorry for some of these poor ministers who are the fall guys if something goes wrong.
And you didn't need to tell me that, Wolfgang.
I've had that experience. Of course, you're better informed on that.
I've had that experience.
On that battlefront, you certainly have had your experiences, I'm sure. But the administrative state, which has been growing and growing all around the West, is, in my opinion, one of the weak points of where we are going in competition with other rising countries like China.
You made mention of municipalities, you know, local governments that want to challenge the Commonwealth Government view about Australia Day. But let me just
make the point. I accept that we should all celebrate Australia on Australia Day, but I wouldn't care if the date was shifted, because it's really about New South Wales, as far as I'm concerned, not when we became a nation. But in any event, I see that as the responsibility of the Commonwealth government, not state governments. But we seem to have got to the point now where anybody who's elected thinks they can operate in anyone else's field, either by way of commentary or direct action. And that in itself breaks down the sort of rules under which we travel together.
Absolutely. We used to have a division of labour between the various levels of government, here and overseas. Now we have self-anointed local governments that want to change a national holiday. In Europe, big cities like Paris and Madrid are prohibiting a certain type of motor car. Maybe they have good reasons, but they don't go through centralized constitutional processes to get their views accepted. Instead, they just rule that diesel cars are prohibited, so that all of Europe, which was driving diesel cars, all of a sudden has to switch out of them. This breakdown of the constitutional order is part of what I talked about earlier when I said that the rule system, the customs and the laws, are getting undermined, and that is a sign of danger for civilization.
I'm talking with Wolfgang Kasper, Emeritus Professor of Economics at the University of New South Wales, Australian Defence Force Academy, about Western civilization and whether it's at an end. And he doesn't think it does. But, Wolfgang, you do think it's about time people in the West stopped navel-gazing and started to learn a bit more about the East so that we could coexist together. And you can't coexist with people that you don't understand.
Yes, I'm frequently in East Asia, and I'm always impressed how much people in China, etc., know about us and how little we in the West know about them. And I think that's dangerous. We have to know a lot about Chinese, if you want, ideas, beliefs, history, not to imitate them, but to know how to push back if they become too aggressive, how best to compete with them. And I would recommend any young Australian with a slight temptation to think about these, to study the history of Confucianism, of Chinese history in particular, because that will be the next big competitor that we in the West are facing.
Indeed. For young people, they better get onto it, otherwise they're going to miss out. Wolfgang Kasper, thank you very much for joining us.
It was a pleasure.
I'm hot under the collar, so I'm looking for that soapbox. There it is. It's about people not saying thank you. What's the matter with thank you? My husband doesn't always do it when I put a meal down in front of him and I say, nice to sit down at the table and have someone put a meal in front of you. Don't even have to say thanks. He just smirks, but expects me to say thank you when he does it for me. Now, what about in restaurants? Sure, you're paying and the waiter's paid to put your food in front of you and you bring your wine and your water and everything else. But is there anything wrong with saying thank you when the plate is put down in front of you? I feel embarrassed sometimes if you go out with a group of people and someone doesn't almost move back for the plate to be put in front of them. They make the waiter go around. They don't say thank you when wine is poured. I mean, okay, you're paying, but you know that person doing it is a person, and it's not a bad thing to acknowledge them and just say thanks. Not a bad thing at all. And I'm told recently a friend of mine was on a bus, and it stopped because the driver could see someone running, you know, puff, 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 I might miss the bus. Gets on the bus and doesn't even say thank you for waiting for me. Huh, what about thank you to the rest of the people on the bus? Thank you, I'm sorry to hold you up. Thank you, it's not a bad word. It's a good thing. It'll make you feel better. Thanks.
great stories of humanity can be passed on through generations, unless identity politics causes some of the great stories to be hidden from our students.
One book of treasure.
Are you a reader? I'm sort of a reader, not a really good one, but I try to be better. It's a great way of taking yourself away into another world and just shutting everything today out. But what happens when academics, instead of looking just at the quality of the book, start to look at gender politics as well? Are the right authors represented? When the representation of the authors becomes more important than the book. I do understand about needing to have some sort of reflection of who society is. After all, why would girls want to go and read only books written by boys? Clearly, it's ridiculous. But you can go too far the other way. Joining me now to discuss just this issue is Bella de Brera. She's director of the Foundations of Western Civilization program at the IPA. Bella de Brera, welcome to Counterpoint.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Now, look, what's the story here with the Queensland University of Technology, some of the academics demanding that when they select the text that kids are going to learn about for the national curriculum should reflect the sexual diversity of the classroom? Look, I get it in the male-female thing, but you can go too far. How do we sensibly manage that balance between presenting authors that are all of one gender or all of one race, and then being crazy with this identity politics stuff? Well, how do we find that right balance?
This suggestion is definitely taking it all way too far. So these academics from the Department of Education at QUT, and they've basically gone and had a look at the selection of texts on the national curriculum and decided that only two of them are diverse enough in terms of reflecting the sexual diversity of the classroom, because they cover things like, you know, the suppressed homosexuality of Nick in The Great Gatsby, and there's cross-dressing in The Twelfth Night. So they sort of just get past their test. But for the academics, the rest of the books in the list just don't reflect what they think is the sexual diversity of the Australian classroom anymore. And I think it's a real shame, because they're just dismissing, you know, great literature. They're not interested in the knowledge and the wisdom of great literature.
Mm. I forget the exact title of a book that I didn't buy, but it was something like 12 great themes of books, or 10 great themes, suggesting that there are a limited number of them. You know, love, tragedy, deceit. And these are human experiences across race and gender, don't you think?
Yes, well, that's the whole point of great literature, and that, you know, these experiences are universal. They're felt by everyone. It's life. Life is all about being happy, being sad, being in love, you know, being heartbroken, being rich, being poor. And these are universal values. And I think this is why somebody like Shakespeare still resonates 400 years later, because he created characters who are human beings. He just reflected humanity in his works. And this is why we can still read Shakespeare now and identify with the things that his characters are going through. But the problem with something like the suggestion that they're making, that we have to just sort of narrow the books down to reflect the people in the classroom, is kind of patronizing as well, because it's saying they can't imagine what it's like to be something else. So it's a real shame. I think it's a real shame, and it's narrowing people's experiences in the classroom of this great literature.
I get the insult, you know, you shouldn't read this because you can't possibly imagine what it's like to
get
into that world.
But
that's exactly what books do, take you to that other place.
I mean, I can't identify with the woman in the 18th century because I just don't live in the 18th century. I have to use my imagination. What would it have been like to have been Jane Eyre? You know, what would it have been like to have been to that terrible school? And what would it have been like to be living in Dickensian London? I use my imagination, and by using my imagination, I develop my own sense of the past, of history, of where we are now. I mean, these novels are so rich, and I think it's a real shame that the students are not going to be exposed to these things.
You make the point that if you want to take this to an extreme, you'll say to a 15-year-old Australian, look, you can't be Macbeth because you just couldn't understand what it's like to be a Scottish king in the 12th century, whereas you're not particularly necessarily wanting him to understand
that king's experience of being king in the 12th century, but of the person and the trials and tribulations surrounding it. That's what you really want them.
Yes, all the other themes that come up. And I just had a look at the list of the books that is on the national curriculum at the moment. There are books that I haven't read because I think, you know, I'm too old. I haven't been to school recently, but I had a look at them. There's things like something called Cloud Street by Tim Winton, and that talks about two working class families in the 40s and the 60s. Again, I'm not working class and I'm not living in the 1940s, but I still think it would be a very interesting read because who knows what I can learn from it. But then, according to their logic, this book can't be on the curriculum because there might be children in the classroom who aren't working class and therefore they can't use their imagination and work out what it would like to be. So really, if you use their logic, you can't read any book because there'll be someone who hasn't experienced what it's like. You know, so it's cutting out all the literature. They're just starting with the sexual diversity of the classroom, but you could go with class and race as well. And then that means that you really can't have any books in the classroom.
Yeah, I get what you're saying. They, of course, don't want to go that far. They just want the books that they want people to look at. Now, let's have a look at the history books that are used to teach history in Australia at the moment. Apparently, there are 147 history topics taught across 35 universities. What can you tell me about that?
So this is a research report that I did last year, which was looking at how Australian history is taught in universities. And in 2018, there were a total of 147 subjects offered by 35 universities, all dealing with, you know, some aspect of Australian history. And the most common theme to emerge from all those subjects is identity politics. So again, class, race and gender. So there's the same obsession with identity politics that they have at the Department of Education or QUT, or, you know, pretty much across the humanities, is evident in how Australian history is taught. And I also looked at how history is taught in general in Australian universities a couple of years ago, and it was quite similar. There were 746 history subjects and 244 of those were all identity politics. But, you know, next year we could have someone else coming along going, look, forget the gender lens, just look at it through race. So this is the problem with identity politics. It's completely limiting.
I'm talking with Bella De Brera, Director of the Foundations of Western Civilization Program at the IPA, about identity politics and its use in history and literature at universities. Let's go back to Shakespeare for 1 minute. His plays must have been translated into, I don't know, how many languages around the globe?
Oh, look, there's probably no language that the plays haven't been translated into. And something that I remember very much from when I was living in London was a festival that they had at Shakespeare's Globe, which was 37 languages in Shakespeare on stage. So you could go along and watch it in Maori or Urdu or Swahili or Japanese or Spanish. And it was incredible, absolutely incredible.
It just makes the companies, point, doesn't it?
Yeah, they had all these companies from all over the world who perform Shakespeare to local audiences in Japanese, and they had them all coming to London. It was the most amazing thing, because it really brought it home that this is universal. Shakespeare bypasses class, race and gender. He speaks to everyone. He speaks through the generations, no matter where you're from, what your gender is, what your class is. This is why Shakespeare is magnificent. And it's quite sad that when you look at the list of books in the national curriculum, there's just one play, there's Twelfth Night. There's no Dickens, there's no Orwell. It's incredible. There's no Hemingway. There's so much missing. It's a real shame, I think.
Do we see now students, I certainly read that we do, but I, you know, it's no more than reading in the paper, and that's just as good as reading a novel half the time. You can't rely on any of it being really true. That students are saying, well, you know, I don't want to study that person because he was a racist. Therefore saying, I'll decide what you'll teach me and what you won't. And a lot of it based on identity politics.
Well, I do know that the numbers of students in the humanities are falling. And I think it has a lot to do with the fact that they know now that if they do an undergraduate degree in history or English literature or politics, sociology, all they're going to get is identity politics. And I think they're getting quite sick of it. I mean, obviously they're getting it at school.
Oh, you think it's the other way around?
Yeah, I think it's the other way around.
Right, okay.
I think, you know, as soon as there's a decent course, especially in history, that teaches students something other than identity politics, it's packed. People want to know things. We've got to give credit to young people for wanting to know things. There's this amazing English professor, Mark Bauline, who teaches English literature in America, and he wrote a book about how technology is sort of dumbing people down. And he basically gets this all the time. You know, he says students are coming to him going, we don't want any more identity politics. It's depressing. We want something else. And I think students are seeing that they're not getting their value for money in Australia. They're paying to do these degrees and all they're getting is identity politics. So I think it's the opposite. I don't think it's students demanding these things. I think it's coming from academia. They're imposing this identity politics on the students.
It might be a bit of both ways. We've certainly interviewed some people from the United Kingdom who've used examples in the United States of students demonstrating to not allow someone on campus because they don't like the view that the person's expressing.
This is a free speech problem that is rampant in American universities, and it's here as well. But the people who demonstrate against them are usually a very small minority of very outspoken and very militant students who don't like to hear alternative points of view. The rest of the students want to know things. They just want to get on with their studies. So I don't think using examples of deplatforming is indicative of what students, the majority of students, want. And I think, you know, the falling numbers and the fact that history is pretty much in decline, people just aren't studying history anymore, reveals everything you need to know about what the problem is with these humanities subjects and the fact that students can see through it.
They're brighter than we think. Bella de Brera, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much. Trying to decipher.
Speaking of identity politics, what if your identity is nicked? With the news that Australian political parties have been subject to cyber attack from a foreign state, whether our devices are safe, both nationally and personally, is a matter of real interest. When you click on a link with your phone, your iPad, whatever, just what are you doing? Who are you getting in touch with? There's a recent article in The Conversation, Don't Click That Link, How Criminals Access Your Digital Devices and What Happens When They Do. To talk about that, we're joined by Richard Matthews, who's a PhD candidate in image forensics and cyber at the University of Adelaide. We've spoken to him before about plastic 3D guns. Richard Matthews, welcome back to Counterpoint.
Thanks for having me, Amanda.
Well, when you're searching the net for something, inevitably some little box comes up that says, test your IQ, or what sort of personality are you? And I think, who the hell is this and why do I want to know what they think? And inevitably you have to go in and do something else before you can participate. It's easy to get sucked in, I suppose.
They're very dangerous things, those. They're applications that are run on the internet, and more often than not, they're just designed to get information out of you for third-party companies to go off and then market and make money out of your information. So applications like Facebook, Twitter, all these free social media companies, it's a free application that we all use every day, but they're a company like anyone else and they've got to make money somehow. So they actually use you as the data. They use you as the product. They market that to their third-party resellers and they then sell ads to you. And that's how they get a profile of what you are, what the product is you are.
So what do they then do with that? I mean, we have talked in the past about Cambridge Analytica and the point they've got to where, if I remember correctly, it's something like less than 18 clicks on Facebook and they can tell your gender, your political voting propensity, probably your ethnicity, a whole range of things that you can't imagine you could tell by 18 clicks. But when you use huge data and algorithms to mine it, you can. But so what? Do I care if Cambridge Analytica know that there's a person, even if they know my name, that has these characteristics? Am I meant to care?
Well, it depends on what your propensity to risk is. And that's really all cybersecurity is all about these days, or information security, as I like to talk about it. It's what your appetite for risk is and your personal information out there. I used to like the band Linkin Park when I was in my teens. Linkin Park is kind of like a grungy, metal-y, punky sort of band, and people would hate that.
I'm just saying I know what you mean. I'm not familiar with either the band or the music.
Exactly.
And it sounds like I don't want to be, but anyway.
But it's that sort of stuff. But they're also tied with some sort of political activism in a way, some of the concepts that they used to talk about in their music. Now, listening to that might not mean anything at all. It might be perfectly benign. But if you start building up a profile of all the people that listen to that, you can start to realize that people that are politically active might be more likely to listen to this band than, say, I don't know, Simon and Garfunkel, which means you can start to make logical conclusions that if I listen to Simon and Garfunkel, I'm not going to be politically active. If I listen to Linkin Park or Rise Against or something like that, I might be politically active. So we can gain an intelligence profile of what you're like. So if you're not uploading this information, but somebody else is, and then we gain an access into what you're doing because you've clicked on a link somewhere else, all of a sudden we can make very critical assumptions about what your life is like without actually knowing what your life is like at all. And this can be things such as your sexuality, whether you're a drug user, all of these things that you might not want people to know.
And I had someone work for me once who was the first to get his security clearance, and one might have thought maybe he wouldn't. And he just rolled up and said to them, "My life's an open book. What do you want to know?" And at the end, the guy from ASIO, who was a retired ASIO person contracted to do these interviews, looked at his watch and said, "Look, I've only got another 10 minutes of my 3 hours. Is there anything else you really need to tell me?" He said, "Yes, whatever you like. I mean, I'm a bit like that. I don't really care, but I understand other people do." And more to the point, I'm a great fan of the principle that if someone doesn't need to know, why should they? I don't want the government sticking its beak into my life or your life or your bedroom or your bank account.
And this is an important philosophy as well. It's the whole need to know principle. However, there's another part to that need to know principle that's not often talked about, and it's need to know but responsibility to share. So I have a colleague who works in Estonia who was at a conference about a year ago, who was talking about how his university recently came under cyber attack and how their vice chancellor was basically being impersonated so that they tried to exfiltrate a whole heap of money out of the university. And as he was standing up on stage and talking about all of this, he noticed a lot of other people from other universities looking very sheepishly in the crowd. And he went up and spoke to them afterwards and found out that this attack was happening to all these other universities as well. But nobody knew about it because nobody spoke to each other. So while it's an operational risk to share that you're vulnerable and you're being attacked, it's actually very critical that you also share that information with people so that we can build up a profile of what's happening. So while companies like Facebook are building up this profile to market, law enforcement are also building up a profile of the attackers so that we can actually defend against it. So it works both ways.
I'm talking to Richard Matthews. He's a PhD candidate in image forensics and cyber at the University of Adelaide about getting hacked. Happens to governments, can happen to you. Now, none of us like admitting mistakes, do we? But it's very important, as you say, to share so that people can, in fact, get a pattern of what's happening, and that's how you catch people.
Exactly.
Right. Now, what are the 10 types of malware that we need to be looking out for?
So the most common types of malware that are out there, it's constantly changing. It's forever evolving. Previously, we used to look at malware, so malicious programs, in terms of what they are, so how they sort of propagate and go onto other computers. So we used to have things like viruses and Trojans and all these other fancy sorts of names. Nowadays, we're kind of moving away from that. We're not really interested in classifying them by what they're called, but more by what they're doing. And this is really important because we're starting to see what's called blended attacks, where malware is kind of being all things at once.
Oh, okay.
So you could go on the internet and for anywhere from about $500 to about $500,000, you can actually buy malware nowadays. The real important thing with all of this is what these programs will do. Now, the most common one that most people will know about nowadays is ransomware or lockerware. And this is what hit Europe and the world, in fact, last year, I think it was, pretty big with NotPetya and all these other types of things where it actually affected the UK health system, locked down all their computers, you couldn't get into it, affected train stations, you couldn't see any of the billboards or anything like that.
What if it happens at home and you've got backup? Will it get into your backup and lock that as well?
It can do. Depends on what it is and depends on how you've backed up your devices. So a backup is not a backup is not a backup, really depending
that's
on what you're doing.
That's comforting to know.
Yeah. So if you've got a backup that's connected to your computer, then yeah, it's gone. It'll be locked as well. If you've got a backup that's disconnected from your computer, so the old sort of like floppy disks or USB drives, USB drives are really bad, by the way, then of course it's disconnected from your computer, so it's not going to be affected by a lockerware or ransomware type attack.
Sure.
USB devices are really bad, though, and I want to stress this. If somebody gives you a USB key, you've got to ask them what their motives are. If you find a USB key just lying on the ground,
don't use it.
Don't plug it in. One of the things that I specialize in now is scaring people when it comes to USB keys.
Good.
I have a USB key that I plug into a computer and it'll navigate itself to YouTube and play Rick Astley's Never Gonna Give You Up every 30 seconds.
Mm.
It's hilarious, it's funny, and that's the great entertainment value. The real nasty ones out there, you can plug into your computer and it'll completely fry it. Or even worse, it'll explode.
Mm.
These things exist. So
yeah, fair enough. Okay.
Physical attacks are just as bad as the software. Looping back to the malware, though, we've got cryptocurrency these days. Some people aren't really all that interested in what's on your computer. They're just interested in making money. So they've got little programs out there that'll take control of some of your processing power on your computer and they'll just start mining cryptocurrency on it.
That's very expensive, isn't it, in power use?
In power use, yeah, most definitely. Your computer will get really, really hot and all of a sudden the fans will start running really hard in order to cool that down and you won't even notice until you get your electricity bill a month later. Another big one is, of course, the classic email attacks that come out. And the favourite one that's going around at the moment is saying, "Dear whatever your name is, you've been a naughty boy. I've got photos of you in a conspicuous position because you've been on a pornographic website and your taste is really great. I did a screen capture of both yourself and what you were watching and I'm going to share it with all your families and friends. And to prove that I actually know who you are, this is your password. And it'll actually be a password that's yours." And the reason why they have that password is because on the internet right now is 33% of the world's population in clear text. Their password in clear text.
Mm.
Password policies are another one of my favourites because every company has a password policy. Yeah. And it's generally something like...
Eight letters,
a capital letter, a random symbol. The best password policy that I've seen is basically three words that are not connected to each other that you can easily remember. So we did this as an exercise to a cybersecurity boot camp a few years ago for the Wi-Fi password, and I can still remember it. It was banana recurve time. However, we still had to obviously apply by the university's password policy, so we had to insert random numbers and stuff. So it was easy to remember again. Banana 1, recurve 2, time 3. 2 years on, I can still remember that password.
So what do we do to protect ourselves?
Use strong passwords, as I've just said. Use these passwords that are going to be easy to remember, but they're long enough that the mathematics of it becomes very, very difficult to brute force.
Okay.
So there's a principle in security where it's either something you know, something you are, or something you have.
Mm-hmm.
And generally, two-factor authentication is using two of those three. And that's something else that you can use. If the website or anything that you're using offers two-factor authentication, take advantage of it. So almost everything that I do is two-factor authentication. I'll type in my password and it'll then still ask me if I am who I am through something else.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing you can do is use unique passwords for all of your things. Now, this is going to be complicated, so you're going to have to take advantage of something like a password manager. A password manager is a piece of software which will then use unique passwords for all of your websites for you.
What you're saying is you don't want someone to use the same password for everything because they can remember it. It's all a bit worrying, really, but nonetheless, if governments can be attacked, it's pretty certain that you and I can be. And Richard Matthews, you've been very kind in giving your time again to explain the risks of all of this to us. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Amanda.
Well, that's it for this week. Thanks for joining us. If you've got something to tell us, just go to the ABC website, go to Radio National, and follow the prompts to Counterpoint. You can do that even if you've got something to ask us. So the answer to the question put to us last week is, what was that music? It was Boundary Rider by the Go-Betweens. Until next week, this is Amanda Vanstone saying au revoir.